I don't remember passing out on the carpet shortly afterwards. The next thing I was aware of was a pounding at my door, and it instantly woke me. I almost shrieked from fear, thinking that the police had somehow found me, and for a split second I was tempted to leap from the window and let the pavement save me from being taken by the police. Thankfully, saner action prevailed, and I glanced through the door's peephole and found that it was only one of my co-workers from the grocery store. Brushing my hair back, I opened the door. "Silverspeak, where have you been?" my co-worker asked. "You were supposed to come in 4 hours ago." I glanced at the clock and saw that he was right. I normally started work at 8, and it was 11. In the chaos of escaping the police and getting home, I hadn't thought of setting my alarm for work the next day. "Sorry," I told my co-worker, making sure to turn on my charm. "Late night party." "I didn't know you partied." "I don't, but I got invited to one. Figured to try it out, and what do you know, I end up drinking too much." My co-worker didn't question my story. I certainly looked the part with my disheveled hair and sweat-soaked skin. "Well, you'd better get down to the store, lickety-split." I wanted nothing more than to go back to sleep. "Can't someone else come in?" "No, we're short-handed enough as it is. I'll tell the boss that you'll be there in an hour." Pressed for time as I was, I could only take a few minutes to shower, followed by throwing every shampoo and conditioner into my hair and skin to make both as presentable as possible. But alas, even in my clean uniform, there was no hiding the fact that I was in no way presentable for working among the public. Still, I went, and, as I guessed, my boss was not happy to see me.
"Silverspeak, you have any idea how late you are?"
"I was at a party."
"Yeah, I was told." "Well, next time, go to a party on a day when you're not going to work the next morning, okay?"
Nodding, I quickly grabbed a cart filled with the latest goods and headed onto the floor, trying to keep myself awake. But as I went, I couldn't help but ask, "Why didn't anyone else come in?"
"You mean you haven't heard? Something at the library last night. Some of your co-workers stole things and are apparently giving details to the police. I don't know all the details yet, but whatever happened was big."
He chuckled.
"Boy, if some pony tries to steal something from there, he's screwed if they catch him. From what I've heard, pretty much the entire police force is out looking for him."
My boss then whistled and went back to work, unaware of how close I came to having a heart attack, right there and then. I went to work that day, thinking that my boss was blowing things out of proportion. He was known to do that every now and then, and the thought of the entire police force going after one pony was amusing. I tried to shrug it off, believing it to be just a fluke. The truth, however, was far worse than I thought. The next morning began what was officially the single worst day in my life. Well, at least up to that point. It began with me heading outside to get the morning paper, and almost fainting upon getting it. The entire front page was running a special on an attempted break-in at the library's forbidden section. I quickly got out on the streets and read the paper in my apartment. It was the only place where I could read and keep muttering, "Oh shit, oh shit, oh shit," without giving myself away, as I turned page after page. It just didn't end. The newspaper not only ran a huge article about the details of the break-in, but also reminded the reader that the forbidden section held the most dangerous and powerful manuscripts outside of Canterlot. The writer helpfully pointed out that only a mad pony, or someone bent on conquest, would be insane enough to break in. I kept up with my steady stream of curses as I went through the articles, reading statements from the police, the librarian, and what few eyewitnesses there were. The overall details was that an earth pony had apparently snuck into the library, but no pony had any idea of who it was, as his face had been covered in paint, making it impossible to identify them. A few late-night partygoers had seen a pony running through the streets in a black suit, but no one had seen where the pony had gone. The police, the article continued, were searching for the guilty pony, but noted that the thief had stopped to save the library's guard from being crushed, and thus he or she was likely not a menace to the public at large. Still, they needed to find out who had done it. The article also mentioned how security was being tightened and additional magical protections were being permanently installed so as to ensure that no pony could ever sneak down into the forbidden section again. But I barely glanced at that part. I was already quickly forming a plan of action. Though their leads were slight, The police almost always found who they were looking for. After reading the paper, I was sorely tempted to cut loose and shriek in utter terror, but I didn't have time for that. Time itself was running against me. I needed to get rid of any evidence that could point to me, and fast. Desperation guided me as I locked the doors, closed the curtains, and began to systematically destroy any evidence linking me to the library. With the speed of a pony possessed, I got my night vision goggles and took them apart, reducing everything to tiny shreds of plastic, metal, and shattered glass. Then came the smoke grenades. I wasn't entirely sure of how to get rid of those, so I turned on a fan for the stovetop and punctured a corner of each can, letting the smoke get sucked away. Within half an hour, all the grenades were empty, and then I used the cutting tool to tear them into the thin slivers of scrap metal. My anxiety lessened somewhat, but I still had work to do. Tossing a few logs into the fireplace, I started a fire, grateful that the storm outside made it so that starting a fire wouldn't be suspicious. The sneaking suit was cut into hundreds of tiny pieces and tossed into the flames where they burned away to ash. Then the belt went in. Being made of nylon, it made a nasty stench, but soon it was gone too. My face paint went in next, then the poncho and the saddlebags. Excessive, perhaps, but I couldn't leave any trace of what I had done. No hoofprints, no traces of DNA, nothing. And when all was turned into ash, all that remained was the cutting tool. Being the toughest thing from the whole operation, I could only undo the screws and take it apart. Demolishing it was out of the question, so I dumped it into the only bag I had left, which had not gone with me on that fateful night, along with the remains of the goggles and grenades, and took a stroll around Manhattan, traveling to numerous coastlines around the island via the subway. At each pier, I would stop often, pretending to peer down into the darkened water. No pony saw me carefully slip a good-sized chunk of debris and scrap metal into the water, where they plunged from sight. After three such visits, I stopped taking the subway and instead took a cab to another corner of the island, where the fourth part was discarded. Two more taxi rides, both in different cabs so as to avoid making the drivers suspicious, and the last parts had been cast into the turbulent sea. One last ride, and I was back home, all evidence of my transgression gone, and only then did my shaking finally stop. I could have gone in to work and stayed there for all afternoon and evening, but my heart wasn't in it. As the storm raged outside, I took refuge in a nice, hot shower. The near scalding water did wonders when it came to relaxing me, and I imagined it washing away my mistake, letting it flow into the drain as if it had never existed. But alas, I couldn't ease my guilt that quickly, for as I scrubbed my mane, I realized that while I had gotten rid of the material evidence, there was one thing I couldn't get rid of. The librarian. My knees gave out, with only a fast grab of a safety bar keeping me from falling. Granted, I was pretty sure I had convinced her that I was no longer interested in trying to get into the forbidden section, but it wouldn't take her more than a second to put two and two together and realize who the most likely suspect was. It wasn't long at all before my shaking came back, this time accompanied by a racing heart and fast, panicked gasps, as my mind put all sorts of horrible situations together. She would tell the police about me. They'd come interview me, and I'd crack and go to jail, or worse, she'd suspect that I was the perpetrator. Without any proof, she'd have to see what I would do. If I stayed away and never came back, that would look suspicious. But if I came back, she'd figure I was only doing so to try and draw suspicion away from me by acting innocent and dumb, and she'd realize that it really was me who had done it, and then she'd tell the police and everything would be so screwed up. The rest of my afternoon was spent trying to figure a way out, yet finding none. It all kept coming down to the librarian. Eventually, I'd have to deal with her, one way or another. And no, I wasn't planning on killing her and dumping the body, if that's what you're thinking. I wasn't that desperate. I just had to show her that I wasn't the pony who had broken in. But for the life of me, I couldn't come up with any way to do so. Fear and dread have a funny way of allowing you to see solutions you hadn't thought of before, if nothing else, to try and get rid of the problem as fast as possible. As the sun continued to set, I realized that the most logical course of action was to play the dumb innocent, guilty of nothing more than wanting to get in, yet never actually doing so. It wouldn't ease my conscience, but at least it might get me off the librarian's hit list, so to speak. The soul-crushing guilt could come later. Thus, with a plan formulated, I finally felt a small spark of hope welling up within me. I gathered up my library books. Returning them would be a convenient excuse indeed. Heck, the due date was 2 days later, and I could legitimately say that I was returning them to avoid late fees. Realizing that I had no way to carry all the books in my hoof, I made a quick trip to a store for a new set of saddlebags. Returning home, I loaded them with my books and headed out to the subway. On the way over, I went over my possible responses to the librarian's inevitable questions and accusations. My main theme would be that, yes, I did want to get in, but I wasn't desperate and stupid enough to want to do something illegal. Besides, my entry hadn't really been breaking the rules, it had been bending them. Restricting access to materials that I desperately needed was stupid anyway. With renewed confidence and the idea that I could end my role in this fiasco within the hour, I got off the subway and entered the library. But it wasn't quite as easy or carefree as last time, for now there were two guards at the doors, and not just any rent-a-guards, but guards dressed in the royal armor of Canterlot. Clearly, the princesses had heard about the break-in, and weren't taking any chances whatsoever about another one taking place. Not that a pony would be stupid enough to try and sneak in with such heightened security. Gulping and acting as casual as possible, I strolled past the guards. Then, realizing that casual was the wrong attitude to have in such a tense environment, I took on the look of someone who was worried but decided to be calm. Yes, that would work, and it apparently did, for no pony gave me a second glance as I walked along, passing unicorns casting magic into new air ducts that were too tiny for a pony to creep through. Reaching the front desk, I found several librarians hard at work, but the main mare wasn't there. Still, the others recognized me for my constant visits, and one or two had apparently heard about my desires to get into the forbidden section, and gave me a suspicious look. Figuring they'd no doubt report this to the librarian when they next saw her, I went to one of them. "Can I help you?" she asked. "Just returning these," I told her, taking out my two cooking books. She looked me over. I noticed that her co-worker was doing the same. "Anything else?" "No, that'll do it." "Funny how you come by here today," she said. "After that break-in and all." Realizing where this was going, I decided to adapt my chosen attitude. "And that means?" "You really wanted to get into the forbidden section a few months ago." "Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. But because I don't want to spend a decade studying a degree I don't want, I guess that's never going to happen now." I looked at the doors leading to the forbidden section, now heavily reinforced with numerous magical locks. And for the looks of things, I couldn't get in even if I wanted to. "That so?" I decided to be a tad aggressive. "Look, I'm not stupid enough to try and break in. I don't want a criminal record, thank you very much. No book is worth that. Besides," I indicated the books, "these are due tomorrow. I didn't want a late fee." I could tell that the mayor was slightly offended by my slight aggression, but it had worked. I could see her realizing that I wasn't lying. Granted, she wasn't aware that I had worked my charm on her and that she had fallen for it, but that didn't matter. The seed had been planted. In time, it would grow, and if I kept visiting, they would realize that no criminal would constantly hang out at the place they tried to break into. She turned to check the books in. I turned to leave. I only got a few steps before I heard a voice behind me. "Hey, you!" I froze as the main security guard walked up. After the hit he had endured, I never counted on him coming back to work so soon, and never expected to meet him. My confidence wavered as he walked up, clearly on edge.
"What are you doing here?"
"Easy, gold calf," the mayor behind the desk said. "He's just returning his books." The guard looked me over, his eyes piercing my own. I looked back, trying to muster as much bravado as I could muster, but that gaze was piercing. Did he recognize me? "Can I go?" I asked. Goldcuff eyed me for a moment longer, then nodded.
"Sorry, sir. Just been kind of jumpy since the break-in. Old instincts die hard, you know. Everyone I see is a threat. It'll go away in time."
He shook his head.
"I swear I'm getting too old for this. First the break-in, and the bugger almost kills me, and saves me. I just don't know what to make of it any more.
Not knowing what to say, I stayed quiet. Goldkoff moved away.
Carry on, then.
I nodded, and as Goldkoff headed back to his rounds, I was pleased. He had been standing not 2 feet away from his attacker, and he hadn't even recognized me. That was good. Very good. I took a step forward, then froze. The librarian was right in front of me. Where she had come from, I didn't know. One moment, Goldkoff had been standing before me, and then it was the librarian. I was so surprised I didn't know what to do, I immediately shifted into excuse mode, ready to explain to her why I was there. But she didn't ask a question. In fact, she didn't say anything. She just stared at me. And to this day, I'll never forget her gaze. It was like watching the blank, emotionless face of a statue. Those eyes. Her eyes were looking straight through me, as if she was reading me and knew my darkest secrets. She knew. All of my carefully planned excuses and challenges were forgotten. My nerve fled me, and I didn't want to be in the same room with her, much less try and talk. It would be like trying to lie to a mind reader. It would fool no one, and make me look like an idiot. My heart was pounding as I walked around her and headed to the door, fighting the urge to run out and get as far away as possible. As I left, I glanced into a mirror. The librarian had turned and watched me as I left. Even in the reflection of a mirror, her eyes met mine. She knew. There was no doubt in my mind when I got back to my apartment. Somehow, impossibly, she knew I had done it. I couldn't explain how. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw her emotionless face, waiting for me to crack and spill everything. She was like an angel who knew everything and was waiting for her damned soul to finally break down and confess under their relentless, unbearable gaze. I paced in my apartment, trying to hold back the fear that was threatening to overtake me. She couldn't prove anything. She had no direct evidence of what I had done, and there was no security footage, no magical images showing what I had done. Everything I had worn that night was either burned to ash or cast into a sea from which it could never be found. She couldn't prove anything. But what if she could? What if she had secretly recorded me? What if there were tricks and methods she had used that and hadn't told any pony about? What if she was simply playing a waiting game, seeing if I would go mad from the guilt and turn myself in, and if I didn't do it by a certain date, she'd probably go and turn in the evidence herself? What if the police were to break into my apartment in the middle of the night, or came after me at work when I least suspected it? That witch. What was she going to do? It was a game of who was going to crack first, and I wasn't going to. She was bluffing. That was it. She was bluffing. She didn't have any evidence at all. She was just going to wait for me to crack, and then bam, place closed, and everything goes back to normal. But that wasn't going to happen. After all, there was only so long she could hold up the bluffing game. Sooner or later she'd give up. I tried to keep that thought ever present as I made dinner, then headed to bed. But despite the events of the day, sleep wouldn't come. I lay there, in bed, staring at the ceiling, trying to calm my mind, but it refused to quiet down. Instead, going over the doubts and fears over and over again, I couldn't get it to shut up. Exhausted and yet unable to sleep, the long hours went by like molasses creeping down an icy slope in the dead of winter. Eventually, Celestia's sun crept in through the window and brightened the room. I barely noticed it, yet somehow, among the blurry haze that was my mind, I realized that the best way to stop the librarian was the same method I had originally planned. Act as if you had nothing to do with the break-in, and were annoyed that you'd been accused of doing so. Yes, that would work. I could adopt that mindset. I was going back into my normal routine and just not let her get to me. Her bluff wouldn't get to me. I was going to show her how wrong she was, no matter how long it took. Despite being exhausted, I managed to head into work and put on my usual cheerful demeanor and help customers find what they were looking for, all while listening to mares and colts gossiping about the break-in. No pony could remember the last time such a thing had happened, and many were afraid that there was some dangerous criminal at work, eager to use magic to overthrow the princesses and take over. Some whispered that it had been a rogue changeling Our elderly customers were sure it was King Sombra or Nightmare Moon. I don't know who it was or what they wanted, I reassured an old mare, but I'm sure everything's going to be all right.
No, it won't, she yapped. You'll see. This is proof. Proof that Equestria is going downhill. It's those griffins. I always knew they were up to no good. They tried to take over and steal our jobs. You know they are. Admit it.
When I got off of work at noon, I promptly went home and slept. The next few days followed the same pattern, except that my sleep schedule finally normalized. But it wasn't enough. I needed to show the librarian that I wasn't scared of her. I went back to the library. I checked out two more books. Granted, I wasn't going to read them, but the mere act of checking them out would show her. After all, would a criminal really be going back to the scene of the crime? Would he be afraid? I saw her again, just briefly. She was helping a patron find a book, and then she noticed me. Once again, her gaze stared towards me. I gave her a defiant wave and left. Heck, she probably heard about my conversation with her co-workers and realized I wasn't her guy, as tempting as it would be to assume so. Eventually, the hullabaloo around the break-in died down. Ponies went back to life as usual, and their headlines turned to other matters. Yet the police continued to search for the culprit, despite the lack of leads. It was an order from the princesses, they explained. Such a break-in was a serious matter. Until they caught the culprit, they would continue their search. I chuckled upon reading that, for what leads did they have to go on? Nothing. And what could the librarian do about me? Nothing. After all, with all the complaints the library was getting about regarding security, she'd want the culprit to be caught so things could go back to normal. If she had evidence, she would have turned it in by then. I should have felt safe. But I didn't. Despite my bravado and constant upbeat thoughts about how I had gotten away scot-free, I couldn't forget the librarian's gaze. When I brushed my teeth, walked about, and even in my dreams, I saw her gaze watching me, silently accusing me. She knew. I began to feel her eyes on me as the weeks passed, then a month, then 2 months, and still the police continued their search. Every possible lead was being followed. Every possible route was being calculated and tracked. I began to think that their search was getting rather ridiculous. I mean, what were the odds that the thief was going to break in again? Yet they kept looking. They kept up with their damn investigation. They wouldn't go away. They wouldn't leave the matter alone. Why couldn't they leave it alone? At one point, I realized that someone was watching me at work. I was sure of it. I could never prove it, of course. I would look back upon feeling someone watching me, but there was either no pony there, or just a guest looking for something. During my breaks, I would hang out in the back room and carve a little hole through the wall. From there I could peek through and look in the store below. I would watch for whoever was watching me. I would watch for the police, because they were coming. I was sure of it. They were watching me on the street. I could feel them there as well. It was harder going out in public. Somewhere. There was someone watching me, or several, all at once. I couldn't escape their gaze, no matter where I went. I saw the police, but they were never heading towards me. Or if they were, they would go right past me on their patrols. They were waiting. I knew they were waiting. Waiting for me to slip up. To give myself away. But I wouldn't. I could beat them at their game. I could win. I would outlast them. I bought my first lock. It wasn't much, just a simple deadbolt that I installed on the inside of my door. Along with a chain lock and normal deadbolt inside the handle, it was good enough. But I realized that if I popped a chair underneath the handle, that would make it even harder to get in. But if one chair worked, why not get another lock to add to it? They might have watched me from the outside, but they couldn't get to me in my apartment, not with all the locks and bolts and props bracing it shut. This would make them redouble their efforts. I was sure of it. I needed to be more careful. Every week or so, there was another headline about the police investigation, and how it was still ongoing, but how those guards from Cantlot were still guarding the library, and would remain there until the thief was caught. Soon it wasn't safe to go outside anymore. Too much of a risk. I would dash to work in the morning, hide in the break room, and then run home afterwards, and lock myself in the apartment. They couldn't get in there. It would take at least 10, maybe 15 minutes to get in. Plenty of time to sneak out through the chimney. The months passed. I could still feel them watching, waiting. I didn't go anywhere anymore. The only reason I still went to work was to get the bits to pay the rent and to get more locks. Only way to stay safe was to wait it out. Wait it out. Wait it out. I could wait out. Easy as pie. I would show them all. They wouldn't get me. Looking back, I'm amazed I didn't have a mental breakdown. I came close, though. I just couldn't see it. But as philosophy books are fond of pointing out, life prefers balance. Tip too far to one extreme, and there'll be a strong corrective action to restore balance. My own corrective force came one morning when I was barricaded inside my room, and thinking about how I couldn't trust my parents. They'd called a few times, but I had grown suspicious of them. What if they were in league with a librarian, and had to teach me a lesson by waiting until I cracked? Shame on you, son, they'd tell me when they were sitting in jail. Why would you do such a bad thing? No, I couldn't trust them anymore. I would have to communicate through a third party, some pony I could hire to take their messages and give my own in return. That was the point when I cracked. It was as if some pony had slapped me on the face. I was going to cut myself off from my parents, the ones who loved and cared for me, and supported me when no pony would. It was as if I had come out of a long nightmare. I looked around my apartment and almost didn't recognize it. All the locks, all the braces, the barricaded doors, and my escape plans. I realized how many conspiracy theories I had. I realized that it was only a matter of time until I believed that the entire city was after me, and that a suicide pill was the only way out. The realization hit me hard. So I did what most ponies would do upon realizing that they were guiding themselves to self-destruction. I drank. I went to the cabinet and pulled out the only bottle of cider I had, extra strong, and drank it all. Through the acidic bite of the cider, everything became clear to me. It wasn't the librarian who was driving me to destruction. It was my conscience. Without even realizing it, my guilt over what I had done was tearing me apart. In the quest to become more than who I was, I had betrayed the one of the biggest lessons my parents had ever given me. The only way to stop the guilt was to resolve it. But how? The answer came to me when the bottle dropped to the floor. There was a way, but it didn't involve going to the police. No way in Tartarus was I going to do that. It was much simpler. Whenever I did something wrong as a child, my parents would make me think about what I had done. They believed the only way to truly correct a mistake was to find out why you had done it, solve that, and then realize that continuing to act as you had done would only bring more pain. You had to close the problem. I knew why I had broken into the library. I knew the reasoning behind it, and had realized the pain it caused. Now I had to ensure that it wouldn't happen again. Going to my room, I took little Celestia and put her on the floor. If I could have done it and gotten away scot-free, I would have done the process with the real Celestia. But the miniature of her would work well in her place. Lying before her, as her calm eyes followed mine, I made a vow. I said, from that day forth, I would never again commit any illegal acts to attain my goals. No breaking into buildings, no sneaking into places where I didn't belong, no stealing, no assaulting, nothing. It had taken the library fiasco for me to realize how wrong that was. I had gotten lucky that time. It might not happen again. That is, if I was foolish enough to do one next time. But there wouldn't be. With little Celestia watching, I finished my vow. The lesson had been learnt, and I would not repeat the same mistake twice. And just like that, it was done. I didn't leave my apartment for the rest of the day. When night fell, I went to the door, pulled the sofa away, and undid all the locks, something I hadn't done in quite a while. I left my home and went outside. I stood and waited. I smelt the fresh air, heard the sound of traffic and ponies laughing somewhere in the distance. I could no longer feel anyone watching me. It felt wonderful. It took a little while, but I could go through my days without looking every which way, at every step, and I could sleep at night without fear of someone breaking in. I was even able to go to the library again and check out books like normal. When I saw the librarian, she still watched me, but I no longer feared her. I would nod, then continue on my way. Her gaze no longer haunted me. On some level, I think I had made my peace with what happened. I was no longer afraid. If they were going to catch me, then so be it, but that was unlikely. 2 weeks after my paranoia had snapped, the newspaper announced that the librarian had officially asked Princess Celestia and Princess Luna to lift the guard, and that the new security features in place would protect the library. And, amazingly enough, her request was granted. The guards left, the library returned to normal, and even the police declared the case to be closed. Though unresolved, as they had found no leads after months of searching, they had to admit the trail was cold. Life was back to normal. Balance had once again been restored. And me? I was content to enjoy my simple life. I went out again to the movies, walked the piers at night, and enjoyed shopping for new clothes and various vanity items I was interested in. I even got a promotion at work and an increased paycheck. For the time being, turning it into an alicorn left my mind. I had been serious upon making my vows, and upon realizing that I probably wasn't going to become one via legal means, I was okay with dropping the matter for the moment. But destiny has a funny way of sneaking up on you when you least expect it. When I came home from work, there was an expensive-looking envelope in the mail for me. Curious, I opened it and found a letter from one of the companies I had applied to when I arrived in Manhattan. Turns out one of their staff writers had quit, and they wanted me to come in for an interview. I wasted no time in dropping the letter, running to the bathroom, taking a fast shower, and pulling on my finest clothes. With my mane and tail slick and shiny, I looked like the finest business pony Manhattan had to offer. Taking the letter, I took off across town and reached the building, delivering the letter myself. The secretary, no doubt impressed by such quick devotion, managed to schedule a job interview on the same day, no less. Going into the interview, I was far more excited than nervous, and found that I could easily breeze through the questions sent my way, adding in my charm, and I was able to easily impress the CEO of the company. Within an hour, I found myself shaking hooves with him, and the proud owner of a new job. I was now officially a professional writer. With my new job in place, I was set up for full-time work, which meant I had to leave my grocery store job. My manager was sad to lose such a valued employee, but he understood my desire to move on to bigger and better things, and told me that if I ever needed a job again in the grocery store business, I knew where to go. Although I had no desire to ever work at a grocery store again, I honestly told him I would remember that, and hope that our paths would cross again someday. After getting my final paycheck plus a nice bonus as a farewell gift, I decided to treat myself for making it to this period of transition in my life. So, on the day before I started, I went out and bought some decorations for the apartment. And once they were installed and set up, I went to the amusement park to have some fun for the first time since the library fiasco. Thus, when I woke on my first day of work, my spirits were refreshed and I was all but bouncing as I entered the giant skyscraper. I quickly settled into a new routine. Though there were no set schedule of things I could do, I had plenty to keep me busy. As one of the writers on staff, my job was to craft speeches, notes, memos, proposals, and anything else the company or any of its employees might need. I wrote press releases, newsletters, and company memos for the upper management too busy or lazy to do them themselves. Things were slow at first, but then I started getting thank you letters from the higher-ups, praising my work for how it had saved them time and also moved readers and listeners as well. I overheard a few of my co-workers talking about how the daily memos and newsletters actually had warmth in them rather than the cold, artificial style so favored by managers. The money started to come in too. It wasn't as much as I was used to, but it was enough to cover all my expenses, plus have a little left over. I even began to branch out and place my name in the classifiers as a writer for hire, and started to getting outside work. There was no job I wouldn't take, no paper I wouldn't write. Well, except for homework and essays that students wanted me to compose. They'd have to learn to do that on their own. Business was steady, and life was good, And, more importantly, I was more content than I had been at the grocery store. I was finally using my talents and skills, and it made life so much better. And like all dreamers, when life is good and everything is going your way, I momentarily let the Alicorn dream fall by the wayside. I told myself I would eventually pick it up again when the time was right. Then the letter came. It was another ordinary day of work when I opened my business mail. Nothing too exciting, a few memos, a few reports, and an invitation to the company picnic. But among them was a rather normal-looking envelope, which seemed out of place. Curious, I opened it and read a letter from an individual wanting my help in writing some business proposals. It was freelance work, nothing I couldn't handle, but writing for her would be a unique challenge, as she was a doctor. I knew almost nothing about the medical field, who knew what type of work she was into. Still, one thing was for sure. Working for a doctor could prove interesting.